My recent mention of the Abraham Lincoln relics in Concord, New Hampshire, prompted Amy D. Burroughs of Wells River, Vermont, to send me a newspaper clipping about a remarkable log cabin up in Grand Isle. According to this editorial, this is not the oldest dwelling in Vermont, but the last authentic original log cabin built by pioneers when that part of America was a howling wilderness. The State Historical Society hopes that by some means the cabin will be preserved, fixed up a little bit, and opened as a museum, so the youngsters of 1945 and 50 can see what a real honest-to-goodness log house looked like in the days when bears and wolves scratched at the back door and blazing arrows and tomahawks whizzed through the windows. The kids of today know all about buzz bombs, rug-cutting, and Superman, but most of them are ignorant of the hardships and hunger their ancestors faced in the days of the log cabin. When my grandfather sold his farm in Rockland, Maine, and retired to Verona Island in the Penobscot River opposite Bucksport, he startled the natives when he announced he was going to build himself a log cabin to live in. Gramp was nearly 80 at the time, and he told his neighbors, "A cabin will last only as long as the bottom logs. When they start to rot, the house comes down." His cabin is still standing today, but of course it's not anywhere near as old as the one on Grand Isle, Vermont. I understand the reason that that one survived the ravages of time and termites is because it was built out of 14-inch white cedar logs, and a recent examination of those timbers shows them to be as sound today as when they were put together more than 200 years ago. I've been mighty pleased lately at the number of letters from listeners who say they prefer Yankee yarns that have an historical twist to background. Being a Yankee myself, I naturally like to tell them, because I think the young folks should know about the old-timers, who in one way or another made history around here. If those grand old ancestors of ours hadn't been brave and husky, we wouldn't be here today to complain about the shortage of cigarettes, gasoline, and nylon stockings. Great Jumpin' Jehoshaphat, what would your great-great-grandmother have done with those things? Likely as not, she smoked a pipe and rode horseback through the mud and brambles to get to prayer meeting. Everybody went to church on Sunday in those times, and if they didn't have a horse to ride, they walked. The men folks went barefoot, carrying their wives and children piggyback through the swamps and wallows. When they reached the horse trough back to the church, they'd stop, take a drink of water, bathe their feet, put on their shoes, and go inside to sit on the hard, cold benches for 3 hours while the preacher pounded the pulpit and shouted to keep them away. There, indeed, they were the real pioneers, the folks who lived in log cabins like the one they're trying to save up in Vermont. Last week, I mentioned briefly the trip the Morey family made from Hartford, Connecticut to Offutt, New Hampshire with all their children and goods in ox carts. That was when those rich, fertile lands along both sides of the Connecticut River in Coos County were being opened up. And young couples with a spirit of adventure and plenty of get-up-and-get thought nothing of striking out alone through the howling wilderness to find and establish a new home for themselves. The Coos intervales were covered with good grazing grass. The Indians were friendly. The streams were full of salmon and trout, and land could be bought for a song. When 22-year-old James Woodard came up from Hampstead to Newbury, Vermont in 1763, he paid only 20 cents an acre for rich, fertile fields bordering what is commonly called the Hoss Meadow. Any old-timer in Coos can tell you how that meadow got its name. Seems that right after the French and Indian War ended, a lot of troops were kept in Canada to preserve peace, just as our boys are doing in Germany today. One group in command of John Foreman got homesick and deserted. They made a canoe out of a hollow tree and started down the Connecticut toward civilization. They had just reached the little oxbow when they saw some horses grazing on the bank of the river, and being nearly starved at the time, they shot one of the animals, and after dark they had their first good steak in months. When morning came, they were aghast to see spirals of smoke coming up from the tall trees of what is now Haverhill, New Hampshire. They thought sure a big Indian powwow was going on, and not wishing to have their scalps pried off with hot stones, they started to leave. But Foreman said, "Well, wait a minute, supposing it's white people." So one of the boys stripped off his clothing and swam over, and to his great joy found a cluster of cabins belonging to settlers from Haverhill, Massachusetts. The boys were forgiven for shooting the horse, given some food, and sent on their way. And ever since, those fertile fields had been called the Hoss Meadow. Sometimes the animals that had been brought into the wilderness got homesick, too. There was, for instance, Colonel John Hurd's best cow, which he'd driven all the way from Portsmouth, a distance of 170 miles, most of the way over a rough Indian trail. The poor beast was all tuckered out when she reached Haverhill, New Hampshire, and was turned loose to graze on the lush grass of Hoss Meadow. She did all right for a week or so and began to gain weight. Then one morning she was gone. Had the Indians shot her as the boys did the horse, or had she wandered into the swamp and been killed by wildcats and wolves? Well, Colonel Hurd engaged three Indian runners and set them in pursuit, but no trace of Bossy was found, and the children had to go without milk. A year and a half went by. And then one day, a man arrived from Portsmouth with letters and general news. The most interesting item to Colonel Hurd being that his cow had arrived back home, a little thin, but otherwise all right. She had walked 100 miles through the forest, down glens and up grades, through rushing streams and across the swamps, without losing her way. It's hard to believe, but at that time, there were no real roads through that part of New Hampshire and Vermont. The stockade at Charlestown was the last outpost of civilization, and almost everything and everybody came up the river in canoes to the fertile valleys called the Co-op's country, first described by Rogers Rangers when they came back from burning the Indian village of St. Francis in October 1759. In his book Northwest Passage, Kenneth Roberts gives a graphic picture of the Co-op's wilderness, where so many courageous Yankees left their mark on that wild, rugged countryside. Among such pioneers was Parson Peter Powers of Hollis, New Hampshire. Peter Powers was brought up according to Puritan custom, and there was no fooling about it. He and his brothers and sisters had to be at family prayers every night at 9 o'clock and then off to bed. One night, Peter was missing at prayer time. Nor did he show up when it came time to put up the shutters against the Indians. All night, the whole family tossed and turned, wondering where he could be in that vast, dark wilderness where wild animals prowled and the Indians lurked. At dawn, when the shutters were taken down, there was little Peter, emerging from the forest, weary and frightened. After the scriptures had been read over the bowls of porridge, his stern-faced father said, "Peter, my son, where did you spend the night?"
"In the swamp, father."
"How did you spend the night?"
"In prayer, sir."
"What were you praying for that would keep you away from home?" Peter swallowed hard and choked back the tears.
"I was praying all night that I might go to college, sir, and learn to preach the word of God."
And so, by great saving and sacrifice, Peter Powers went to Harvard. And when he graduated, he went up to the wilderness of the Co-op and built a log cabin church. Then he put a birch bark canoe on the riverbank, so the good folks of Reigate and Bradford, who'd walk 10 miles, could get across the river and hear him preach the gospel. There's a good story about Judge Ladd's wife and the excitement she caused in that same log church when she arrived from Haverhill, Massachusetts. She was accustomed to wearing the best go-to-meeting duds when she went to church in the city, and on this Sunday she had on a blue silk dress with muffled cuffs and brilliant sleeve buttons. She wore the first pair of silk stockings the natives had ever seen, and high-buttoned shining leather shoes, and the judge had a tall silk hat and a gold-headed cane. But they went alone, sat alone, and returned alone. Not a soul would go near them, for fear of soiling their silks and satins. The next Sunday, Judge Ladd and his wife appeared in plain homespun clothes and were warmly greeted by their new neighbors. Among those neighbors was James Woodard, the young man who came to the Co-op when he was 22 and bought land on Horse Meadow for 20 cents an acre. Like all the early settlers, he put up his tent on the meadow, not realizing that floods frequently covered the fields. After being washed out a few times, he built a log cabin on the hill, and there he lived in single blessedness until Judge Ladd arrived with a honey of a hired girl named Hannah Clark. Hannah was only 15, but she was, according to local historians, possessed of a fairy form, sparkling eyes and ruby lips. And being smart and sensible, the lads figured she'd make a good wife for their son John, as soon as she was a year or two older. Well, Mr. Woodard went to call on the judge one day, but when he saw Hannah, he forgot what the errand was. And apparently she felt the same way about him, for she blushed and blinked and twisted her handkerchief, and if ever a Cupid's dart did double duty, it was right then. James Woodard didn't go to the lads often enough to rouse suspicion, but when he did call, he always managed to leave a note or drop a word for the pretty hired girl. Finally, Mrs. Ladd got wise to what was going on, and put her high-button boot down flat and told the young man he'd have to stop casting sheep's eyes at Hannah. She was being saved for John, and he was just wasting his time. Even in the wilderness, love will find a way. And for a whole year, the lovers had to be content with notes and little pretties smuggled back and forth. How to get hitched was something else again. So Woodard went to Judge Bailey's son and asked for advice. Mr. Bailey proved to be a friend in need. He sent James after a license and dispatched a messenger to Reverend Peter Powers, asking that he come in his canoe to a spot in front of Woodard's cabin on a certain day at a certain hour. Then he sought his own sweetheart, Hannah Fellows, and told her what to do. Go over to the lads on a friendly call and get Hannah Clark to walk back to the riverbank. It was as simple as that. A few days later, as the golden light of late afternoon lay upon the Co-op, the two girls strolled down to the riverbank just as Parson Powers paddled up in his canoe. And in the log cabin a few minutes later, Hannah Clark and James Woodard were made man and wife. Hannah then hastened right back to get supper for Judge and Mrs. Ladd, And the bridegroom did his chores, fed his horse, and slept on the cool green grass of his meadow under the twinkling stars. About 2 weeks later, Miss Essie Gusset came to call on the lads. As she sipped her tea, she gabbed and gabbed, and then said with a lift of her eyebrows, "Such talk as is going the rounds in Newbury Center. I told him it couldn't be true." And Mrs. Ladd said, "And what is the gossip, Essie? Do tell me." "Well," Essie said, "they do say as how your hired girl has up and married that nice Mr. Woodard. Married him right under your nose and all." Mrs. Ladd laughed and laughed. "Not much chance of that, Essie Gusset. Hannah Clark will marry our John come Christmas." Miss Gusset stirred the sugar in her cup and said slyly, "You'd know, wouldn't you, if she was married?" "Of course I would. Hannah hasn't left this house." "Oh, no. Oh, my goodness. Wait a minute. That man in the canoe. He did look like Parson Powers. Oh, it can't be. Hannah Clark. Hannah Clark, come here this minute." Hannah came, blushing like a ripe tomato and just as luscious. Mrs. Ladd scowled. "Hannah Clark, be you married to Mr. Woodard?" The girl hung her pretty head. "Yes, ma'am, I be." "Then you may go. You may go at once. Never let it be said that Judge Ladd's wife kept a man from his bride." So Hannah gathered up her duds and went to James Woodard on the rich meadows that he'd bought for 20 cents an acre. And there they lived happily in a little log cabin, very like the one they're trying to save in Grand Isle, Vermont.